Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be able to talk about the emergency hiring program in Kenya. And I'd first like to acknowledge some of the key contributors to this program and also the authors of this paper, and also our funder, USAID. The Capacity Kenya project was a part of a 5-year global project called Capacity Project. And the lead organization for this was IntraHealth International. And Capacity Project's main goal was to improve human resources for health. And I don't have any relationships to disclose. So let me give you a little background about Kenya. Kenya, like many of the other sub-Saharan African countries, has a very large public sector. In fact, 60% of all health facilities in the country are public sector, and 21% of the facilities are by faith-based organizations. Within the public sector, you have dispensaries, which compose almost 71% of all facilities, and they're the lowest level facilities in the communities. Then there's health centers, district hospitals, regional referral, and national hospital. The health workers, the main health workers, are composed of enrolled and registered nurses. As you can see, almost 43% are nurses, and then 5.5% clinical officers, physicians, and the others compose cadres such as pharmacy technicians, laboratory technicians, public health officers, etc. Kenya, like many of the other countries, has some huge disparities in how the health workforce is distributed. And as you will see, let's see if I get this, Northeastern Province is one of the more rural provinces in the country. It's mainly has a lot of nomadic population, and there are very few cities. And as you can tell, it also suffers from having some of the fewest number of health workers per 100 population. So in general, some of the disparities that we identify in Kenya are issues with recruitment and deployment of health workers to hard-to-reach areas, retaining workers in these areas, and also staff shortages over the past 10 years. And as many of you know, that there was a long hiring freeze for 10 years in Kenya beginning in 94. And the result of that is that actually they had less health workers 10 years later. In 96, there were 50,000 health workers. And in 2009, the public sector only had 37,000 health workers. So they actually lost a lot of health workers because they couldn't replace them. Recruitment at the public sector was typically done at a central level recruitment. And some of the challenges that that posed was, first of all, it's slow, it's costly, and when they recruited centrally, they didn't advertise for the particular areas where there were openings. And so it became very difficult to recruit for some of the rural, hard-to-reach areas. And some of the more current literature really emphasizes trying to decentralize some of the recruitment processes. And one little anecdote is over the last year, they had a hiring program to hire 20 nurses per community in Kenya, resulting in an ability to hire 4,200 nurses. But in Northeastern Province, which was the province which had the lowest uptake of staff, they were supposed to hire 240 nurses, but were only able to hire 46 nurses. And the nurses that did take up a position in Northeastern Province were predominantly those nurses that originally came from those areas. And so we see that we need to look at some innovations in how we identify and recruit and train health workers for hard-to-reach areas. So what is the emergency hiring program? Back in 2005, the government of Kenya embarked on the emergency hiring program to do two main things. One was to fill some of the gaps in hiring, and secondly, to look at improving some of the hiring practices. And some of the development partners that participated in the emergency hiring program are listed here, and in addition to the capacity project. The main aim of the emergency hiring project was to increase staffing in essentially hard-to-reach areas or in areas that had a very high rate of HIV/AIDS. Let's get to the right place here. But the emergency hiring programs themselves took up the role that the ministry would previously have done, even though the people that were hired were actual government employees and they were paid for by these projects. But the projects had to do the recruitment, develop the contracts for these health workers. They had to pay the salary and subsidies. Because these workers weren't getting retirement benefits, they paid what they call a gratuity that would essentially cover the retirement benefits, and deploying these staff. The capacity project mainly hired nurses, clinical officers, laboratory staff, and pharmacy technicians. And the two main purposes that we're trying to answer with this paper is how can capacity, can you improve hiring practices for the public health sector using the emergency hiring model, and how effective was this model? So the approach. And I'm not going to go through every step of the hiring process because in general, it is the same process as many of us would go through, except that with the project, we had to then collaborate between the government agencies and the provincial agencies and some of the local agencies to really go about hiring these workers. And everything had to be approved by the Ministry of Health, because again, these were going to be ministry workers. And so we continued to have to follow some of the procedures that the ministry would typically have followed with the government of Kenya so that these workers were considered government of Kenya health workers. And so the initial step was really identifying the vacancies with the key collaborators at the provincial level and then getting those approvals ratified by the central ministry. We then had to go through the advertising process. And we had to prepare the advert, get it approved, and then had to set up a process for receiving these applications. And through this first phase of the hiring process, we actually still had the applications sent to the central ministry, but the provincial directors actually were participating in identifying what staff they needed and the processes that we would go through. So while we received the applications, we actually set up an Excel spreadsheet that would really expedite receiving the applications and then identifying which of the applicants actually had the criteria that was advertised for. And that really cut down a significant amount of time because previously it was all done manually. There wasn't an electronic process, and it would have taken months to have identified which of the health workers really met the criteria. After holding some of the working with the provincial level staff, we had to figure out, okay, what were the next steps going to be? How were we going to discern who was going to be shortlisted? So we set up criteria and aids to really make sure that the process was transparent. Because in Kenya, as in many other countries, there's a lot of things that otherwise happen sort of under the table about who got hired. And so we wanted to make sure that the process stayed very transparent. The shortlisting process happened at the provincial level after the we identified which of the health workers met the criteria. And so we set up local teams, in addition to some of the Ministry of Health personnel from the central level, to determine where we're going to interview, what criteria we're going to use for selecting, and also what questions everyone was going to be asked. We also, in the process, checked to be sure that all of the professionals were licensed with the regulatory bodies. And as you know, and typically what they did before was just have people bring in a copy of their certificates. But we found in checking through the regulatory bodies that there were quite a few people that actually had fake certificates. So we literally went back to the regulatory bodies before accepting any of the health workers for the final interview. And as I said before, the interviews were done with the local staff, with some of the cadres that we were recruiting for, and also with some of the staff from the central ministry. The interview process, after the interview process, we selected the key workers, and then actually what we did also during the interview is we came up with several ways to follow up with people. Previously, they would just have one telephone number, and we found a lot of people weren't retraceable. So we made sure that during the process, we actually got email addresses, other contact information, so that if one method of reaching people didn't work, we actually could follow up with other people. And after selecting the people to fill the key positions, all the staff then had to have an appointment letter that was actually, we wrote, but it was actually signed by the Ministry of Health. We actually started to use some other methods for reaching people by using text messages. When we first started this, we would call people, run adverts. There actually are three steps where you have to run an official advertisement, but still for people that lived in hard-to-reach areas, it was still hard to reach them. So we found that by having a program that automatically sent text messages out to everyone, and it would actually aggregate the data and identify who responded and didn't, and coded the responses, it really cut down some of the time and the missed opportunities to locate people. We also then loaded the data into an information system so we could track people. And the last step was developing an induction process. In Kenya, health workers had not gone through an orientation process for probably 3 to 4 years. So a lot of the health workers were brought on board without really knowing what they were supposed to do. And the induction process also included a short course on integrated HIV prevention, care and treatment, PMTCT, as well as some other things, which really improve their satisfaction as well as their ability to function. So what were some of the results? We found that by using this hiring process, we were able to reduce the time from almost 1 year down to 3 months to hire a health worker. We found that by advertising according to the province and the type of job that was needed, it actually gave us more, a higher level of response and people that took up the jobs. And in the qualitative interviews we did, the respondents indicated that they felt the process was fair, transparent, and they really appreciated the clear job responsibilities, which previously didn't happen. And health workers knew before that there were a lot of informal things that happened in the hiring process. And so they really appreciated that. And one little quote was, before I came here, I was not even sure how to administer ARVs to children. With the knowledge I've gained, I feel equipped to manage the comprehensive care center. So they really did appreciate this. We also found that we were able to hire all 830 high priority posts, although it did take 3 recruitment phases. But the exciting thing was 46% of these people hired were previously unemployed. And again, as I said, people were trained in the past but not hired for almost 10 years. So we were able to absorb some of those people that had not been working. And the retention rate, 91% retained the positions from 2005 to 2007. And we were able to keep people mainly in some of the hard-to-reach areas, and actually it allowed us to open up clinics that had previously been closed. And after the program was over, we were able to have the ministry absorb all of these health workers into the public sector employees. So what we found that the emergency hiring program was an effective approach to improving and expediting hiring of health workers in Kenya, especially in hard-to-reach areas. We were able to come up with some processes to expedite hiring and also making the process much more transparent. But some of the challenges existed that not all the steps were quite as clear-cut as we would want them to be. We still are refining each of the steps. Sometimes they still had some deviation from the deployment plan that the ministry had approved, and people tried to recruit people for other posts that weren't offered. And some of the steps that we had hoped to handle at the provincial level were still handled at the central level, although now we actually have decentralized those processes more than they did through the first phase. And at the time, the information database was incomplete for health workers, although we now have it up and running. So some of the recommendations. I think that for this model to be successful in some countries, there needs to be a recognition that there is a surplus of health workers. Otherwise, you'll just be moving health workers from one sector to another. There needs to be a shift and a willingness to want to decentralize some of the processes. And there needs to be a willingness on the part of the government to really adapt innovative processes for improving efficiency in the hiring practices. But I do believe, and there needs to be a willingness to want to do things in a transparent way. Because I will share that there were many times in the process that there was pressure from very high positions to try to fill positions in other ways. And we had to really be willing to go back and say, this was the agreement. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Pamela. We'd like to open it to questions now, question and answer period. If we have some questions for the last two speakers who haven't had questions yet. You had your hand up first.
Thank you very much for an excellent presentation. I would just like to know, with your experience from Kenya, you talk about the losses of the health workers, because when you talk about strengthening the health system, one of the foundation, building blocks is the human resource for health. And in the continent, we're losing this human resource for health. And I didn't get a clear picture. Where are they going? What happened to them? Are they migrating, or they're pulling into other industries? Sometimes the influx of non-profit organizations from abroad has actually weakened the public health system, because they come in and they pay very high salaries, and so all the health workers just pull out of the health system, which causes us to weaken the public health system. So this will end much better, but the health system suffers. So what happened to these health workers?
Right. Well, as I said early on in the presentation, the government was not hiring for 10 years, but they continued to produce health workers. And so for that time period, there was some of those workers were being absorbed by the FBO and the private sector. But a lot of these workers, because they didn't have opportunities to work, were going to other parts of Africa. Some of them went to, and there actually were some programs to distinctly move people to other countries because there weren't jobs for them in Kenya. So yes, they did move to other countries, but now we're starting to see that there is some resurgence of workers coming back because the hiring has resumed in the last couple of years.
Good. More questions?
I noticed that there was a period of 2 years where you evaluated the retention of the areas, but 2 years is a very short period of time, and it was not clear to me if there was incentives or that just the process was systematized to the point that it was better selection. But and I remember that there were some salary subsidies, but I'm also wondering if there was non-monetary incentives for the workers to stay in the hard areas.
That's a great question. The reason that we just had that first 2 year is that actually there were contracts, some of them lasted 1 year, some lasted 2 years, some lasted 3 years. And so because of the contracting process and then the time it took for absorbing people, we actually just tracked the first 2 years. But actually at the time of the program, at the end of the 2009, we actually did have pretty much the full number of people still on board, and they were absorbed by the ministry. It's just the contracts ended. Some ended in 2008, some ended earlier, and so it was hard to look at that same denominator over the entire time period. But there weren't, apart from the gratuity for the that took the place of retirement and the additional training that these workers received, they received the same salary as health workers working for the ministry received. There weren't other types of informal benefits.
Okay, any questions for any of our other speakers? Oh, could we have a whole bunch of other questions. Could you hold that in for a second? Okay, thanks.
I have two questions.
Okay.
So the first one is that you mentioned Ghana and Rwanda as success stories, and I'm not sure how much longer the Rwanda program has been running than the National Health Insurance Scheme in Ghana, but it seems that the coverage is almost twice as high. So aside from Rwanda being a much smaller country, what are some things that you think happened in Rwanda that didn't happen in Ghana that influenced the coverage that much? And then my second question is, by decreasing these out-of-pocket expenses, obviously, we're going to expect that there's going to be an increase in utilization of health services. So, and essentially, we're kind of assuming that the health facilities have the capacity to respond to that increase. So, were there any simultaneous initiatives to ensure that the health facilities would be able to respond? And if not, what did you see in terms of them being able to respond?
Yes, Rwanda and Ghana have more or less increased their coverage over the same time period. My analysis of the situation is that in Rwanda, the political situation is much more focused than in Ghana, which allowed an increased amount of attention to the subject. In other words, the president of Rwanda is very involved with that particular policy and will make sure it will work. Whereas in Ghana, there have been several rounds of democratic elections and a lot of political changes. However, things still have gone forward. Yes, decreasing out-of-pocket expenditures. We hope it will increase use of modern health services. Sometimes we're not so sure whether health systems will follow. We do want to have quality care for the people who are coming. Otherwise, they're going to be disappointed and wonder why they're coming anyway. What they've done in Ghana is that they brought in contracting to private providers to pick up some of that slack, and private providers, because of the fact that they are being paid for their work through the system which they have created in Ghana, do provide quality systems which have been able to pick up the extra demand. And in Rwanda, it has been a largely public push to making sure that the services are there for the added demand on the part of the public who are now able to go get the services.
Okay, thank you, Christine. Question in the back?
My worry about eager to enroll. In the two countries you mentioned, if I remember correctly, Rwanda initially was voluntary. But at some point, the government intervened and made it compulsory. In Ghana, if I remember, then it came. I think from the beginning, it was made compulsory. So I think that the combination of those two things, one, making it compulsory and then donor assistance, actually were the key to making success stories in those two countries. I don't know how correct I am in this.
Can you hear me if I talk from here?
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. Part of the bottom-up, top-down approach is at the bottom, often at community level, starts with voluntary small initiatives which create the trust and the type of institutions which communities can adhere to. And as you get to a certain tipping point, the government can come in with legislation and financial support, as in Ghana and Rwanda, where it became somewhat obligatory, more obligatory in Rwanda than in Ghana, to join in the some sort of scheme, some sort of coverage. Whether you're in the formal sector in Rwanda and you're working in the public sector and you belong to something similar to a social health insurance, or if you're a rural farmer, you belong to a more community-level, community-based mutual. But they are all now encompassed within a national health insurance system that tries to balance out the benefits and make sure that even the poorest of the poor who are paying into what they can to their community initiatives also are subsidized from the top and can get secondary and tertiary care for their own system.
Okay, we can come back to you after a minute. Do you have a question?
Hi, this question is about the Bangladesh project. And I haven't caught wind of it for several years, so it may be a little outdated, you can correct me. But it was my understanding that there was essentially a mass poisoning through arsenic found in the drinking water, which was introduced through the boreholes. And I was wondering if that intersects with your project at all, if it's led to increased rates of breast cancer through the drinking water, or if you know anything about that.
I don't know a whole lot about that, but we've talked about it as a research team, about exploring that issue. It's a fascinating idea to look at arsenic in relationship to breast cancer, and that's something that we're talking about doing. In fact, I'm in a PhD program at Arizona State University, and one of my cohort students is thinking about looking at that issue as well. So it's a new thing to look at. Thanks for the question.
Okay. Did you have another question?
Yeah, sure. Ms. Ortiz already answered partly my question, but did you elaborate any more about the quality assurance that was introduced in the nutrients? Because they were private providers that, but I mean.
Quality assurance will vary from country to country and from system to system and the rate of development within the system. If you're looking at, for example, community health insurance programs in a country like Niger, where they are doing it, there is very little quality assurance. Whereas in Rwanda, they have instituted a very vigorous system of monitoring and evaluation all throughout the system to make sure that the quality of care is good. So one size does not fit all, and in my opinion, it is a progression, it's a process that you can see things develop and different aspects grow and build on each other. And yes, quality assurance is a necessary part of making sure that people actually do want to come into the modern healthcare system. But I can't give you any specific model because there isn't one that fits all of them.
Okay, any other questions? I had a question myself for Pamela on the emergency hiring plan. I just wanted to ask if you could enlighten us about who is actually paying these new health workers, because you said that at the end of the project they were passed over to the Ministry of Health.
And who was paying for their salaries?
The ministry.
In the meantime.
First 3 years, USAID paid the salary. Just like I showed you the other donors, I mean, there's Clinton, UNICEF, the 873 workers that Capacit Project hired were paid with support from USAID until they were absorbed by the Ministry of Health.
And that was how many staff?
873.
Uh-huh, okay.
And actually, in the next phase of Capacity Project that we're doing right now, there's a similar program where we've hired 700-some health workers to work across the country through the provincial programs that they have. But again, with the hope that they will be absorbed.
Yeah, okay, thank you. We have time for one or two more questions before.
Was payment necessary to which the Ministry of Health is paying? Is it going to absorb them afterwards? Would there not be some issues to do with compensation and if the rates are different?
Yes, the workers that we hired were paid the exact same salaries as they would have been paid by the ministry, so that there weren't any problems with later absorbing them by the ministry.
Okay, oh, we're getting a bunch of more questions here. Okay.
I have a question for the Bangladesh project. You had mentioned under social and cultural barriers, the preference for traditional medicine and fear of the medical system. Can you talk about any strategies that you've seen that have been effective in overcoming those kind of barriers?
One thing that we did do is we went and actually talked to some religious leaders and share our program with them. We talked a lot about doing some kind of intervention along those lines, but we haven't gotten that far yet. But it's something that we're considering doing. Maybe it could be influential. As far as being able to tell you how much our discussions with religious leaders had an influence on referrals, I don't think we know.
Yeah, one more question over here. One or two.
Also about the Bangladesh project. It sounded like the relationship that you built with the NGO, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name, was kind of an unusual one in that they were not health-related or, I assume, not even related to women's rights or anything like that. How did that partnership come about? Did you have to reach out to, did you reach out to the community and try to get this partnership, or did it just...
I actually used to work in Bangladesh from 2000 to 2001, and I worked in a family planning, population planning related program. And this organization actually did have some, they did some health education type activity. And so I contacted them at that time, and I'd gotten familiar with their program. And when I started going back there, I knew based on my experience going out in the field and seeing what they did, that they had a close relationship with the communities, that they could be trusted. And that was a really big concern of mine, was finding a partner we could trust. As far as administrative issues go, management issues. And it really ended up being a nice fit, and it was very complimentary because it was an IT-related organization. And to expand that a little bit more about health, knowledge transfer is how we describe it, information transfer type organization. They had skilled staff that could run computers so we could do tracking, we could collect data without having to do a lot of training. They had the space, and they were familiar to the community. So it ended up being a really nice fit for us.
Just two quick questions for my colleague from Ghana on the project. In terms of sustaining community behavior, you made mention about building a relationship between the providers and the community members. And I was wondering whether there were community structures or platforms supported by your program, and so that on a continual basis after the program is finished, that those community behaviors can be addressed and be changed on a sustainable basis.
Okay, you know, in our country, around health clinics, we have some members, community members, who have to help the health provider to manage health activities. There are some people from the community.
It's like a facility, a community.
Yeah, a community. Yeah. they have the charge in charge to how to manage the register, but if no one is not working, it's why by our affiliates we reinforce them to help them to how to manage the health system as the people want them to do. You know, it's not, you know, health government have many things to do. But now we want community to help government to manage the family health. But they, we have to help them that it work, it will work. And if the health community centers are members are working well, we have also people to go and tell people what to do how to behave so they will have a good health. It's why we reinforce also community health workers. Because they are with communities, they are there. They will even I forgot to explain it. For all the visits, we the health workers have some household which they have to cover. So with 3,310, they have to cover all the visits. If they we have to supervise them to do their work.
Like an outreach program.
Yeah.
Okay. I think there are some more questions, but the session is now officially over since we're after 4 o'clock. Unless you all want to stay and keep asking questions, that's fine too. They need. Yes. Anyway, I think we should have a round of applause for our four interesting presentations. And thank you all for coming to this session.